Ibsen does not profess to know how virtue and happiness are brought about in the sense that he professes to know how our modern sexual tragedies are brought about. Falsehood works ruin in the pillars of society, but truth works equal ruin in the wild duck. There are no cardinal virtues of Ibsenism. There is no ideal man of Ibsen. All this is not only admitted, but vaunted in the most valuable and thoughtful of all the eulogies upon Ibsen, Mr. Bernard Shaw's Quintessence of Ibsenism. Mr. Shaw sums up Ibsen's teaching in the phrase, quote, "The golden rule is that there is no golden rule," end quote. In his eyes, this absence of an enduring and positive ideal, this absence of a permanent key to virtue, is the one great Ibsen merit. I am not discussing now with any fullness whether this is so or not. All I venture to point out with an increased firmness is that this omission, good or bad, does leave us face to face with the problem of a human consciousness filled with very definite images of evil and with no definite image of good. To us, light must be henceforward the dark thing, the thing of which we cannot speak. To us, as to Milton's devils in Pandemonium, it is darkness that is visible. The human race, according to religion, fell once, and in falling gained knowledge of good and of evil. Now we have fallen a second time, and only knowledge of evil remains to us. A great silent collapse, an enormous unspoken disappointment, has in our time fallen on our northern civilization. All previous ages have sweated and been crucified in an attempt to realize what is really the right life, what is really the good man. A definite part of the modern world has come beyond question to the conclusion that there is no answer to these questions, that the most that we can do is to set up a few notice boards at places of obvious danger to warn men, for instance, against drinking themselves to death or ignoring the mere existence of their neighbors. Ibsen is the first to return from the baffled hunt to bring us the tidings of great failure. Every one of the popular modern phrases and ideals is a dodge in order to shirk the problem of what is good. We are fond of talking about liberty. That, as we talk of it, is a dodge to avoid discussing what is good. We are fond of talking about progress. That is a dodge to avoid discussing what is good. We are fond of talking about education. That is a dodge to avoid discussing what is good. The modern man says, let us leave all these arbitrary standards and embrace liberty. This is, logically rendered, let us not decide what is good, but let it be considered good not to decide it. He says, away with your old moral formulae, I am for progress. This, logically stated, means let us not settle what is good, but let us settle whether we are going to get more of it. He says, neither is religion nor morality, my friend, lie the hopes of the race, but in education. This clearly expressed means we cannot decide what is good, but let us give it to our children. Mr. H.G. Wells, that exceedingly clear-sighted man, has pointed out in a recent work that this has happened in connection with economic questions. The old economists, he said, made generalizations, and they were, in Mr. Wells' view, mostly wrong. But the new economists, he says, seem to have lost the power of making any generalizations at all. And they cover this incapacity with a general claim to be, in specific cases, regarded as experts. A claim proper enough in a hairdresser or a fashionable physician, but indecent in a philosopher or a man of science. But in spite of the refreshing rationality with which Mr. Wells has indicated this, it must also be said that he himself has fallen into the same enormous modern error. In the opening pages of that excellent book, Mankind in the Making, he dismisses the ideals of art, religion, abstract morality, and the rest, and says that he is going to consider men in their chief function, the function of parenthood. He is going to discuss life as a tissue of births. He is not going to ask what will produce satisfactory saints or satisfactory heroes, but what will produce satisfactory fathers and mothers. The whole is set forward so sensibly that it is for a few moments at least before the reader realizes that it is another example of unconscious shirking. What is the good of begetting a man until we have settled what is the good of being a man? You are merely handing on to him a problem you dare not settle yourself. It is as if a man were asked, what is the use of a hammer? An answer, to make hammers. And when asked, and of those hammers, what is the use? Answered, to make hammers again. Just as such, a man would be perpetually putting off the question of the ultimate use of carpentry, so Mr. Wells and all the rest of us are, by these phrases, successfully putting off the question of the ultimate value of the human life. The case of the general talk of progress is indeed an extreme one. As enunciated today, progress is simply a comparative of which we have not settled the superlative. We meet every ideal of religion, patriotism, beauty, or brute pleasure with the alternative ideal of progress. That is to say, we meet every proposal of getting something that we know about with an alternative proposal of getting a great deal more of nobody knows what. Progress, properly understood, has indeed a most dignified and legitimate meaning, but as used in opposition to precise moral ideals, it is ludicrous. So far from it being the truth that the ideal of progress is to be set against that of ethical or religious finality, the reverse is the truth. Nobody has any business to use the word progress unless he has a definite creed and a cast-iron code of morals. Nobody can be progressive without being doctrinal. I might almost say that nobody can be progressive without being infallible, at any rate, without believing in some infallibility. For progress, by its very name, indicates a direction. And the moment we are in the least doubtful about the direction, we become in the same degree doubtful about the progress. Never, perhaps, since the beginning of the world has there been an age that had less right to use the word progress than we. In the Catholic 12th century, in the philosophic 18th century, the direction may have been a good or a bad one. Men may have differed more or less about how far they went and in what direction. But about the direction, they did in the main agree, and consequently they had the genuine sensation of progress. But it is precisely about the direction that we disagree. Whether the future excellence lies in more law or less law, in more liberty or less liberty, whether property will be finally concentrated or finally cut up, whether sexual passion will reach its sanest in an almost virgin intellectualism or in a full animal freedom, whether we should love everybody with Tolstoy or spare nobody with Nietzsche. These are the things about which we are actually fighting most. It is not merely true that the age which has settled least what is progress is that progressive age. It is moreover true that the people who have settled least what is progress are the most progressive people in it. The ordinary mass, the men who have never troubled about progress, might be trusted perhaps to progress. The particular individuals who talk about progress would certainly fly to the four winds of heaven when the pistol shot started the race. I do not therefore say that the word progress is unmeaning. I say it is unmeaning without the previous definition of a moral doctrine, and that it can only be applied to groups of persons who hold that doctrine in common. Progress is not an illegitimate word, but it is logically evident that it is illegitimate for us. It is a sacred word, a word which could only rightly be used by rigid believers and in the ages of faith.